on daytime radio shows about carer's allowance. I would take up pottery. I would steal rare weekends away. I would wear comfortable peach-coloured tracksuits. I would say, coping, thank God, coping. All these things I thought of before readying myself and making the short drive to see my father, afraid all the time of what I would find.
Catherine Parkinson was reading Lost Weekend by Hugo Kelly. The producer was Heather Larmer. And tomorrow's story in the Defining Moments strand by New Irish Writers is The West Link Upgrade by Colin Carberry. A young couple begin to realise their relationship has changed. They've fallen in love.
Ambridge Extra returns to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
He was the most wonderful, kind-hearted man I've ever met. Then there were misunderstandings.
I'm sorry.
I got angry. And then he was gone.
The story continues as Matt and Lillian face the truth.
Oh, never mind. Let's just forget it.
What?
Well, you're clearly hating every minute of this.
What are you talking about?
Doesn't matter.
Ambridge Extra begins Tuesday afternoon at 2:15.
The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now our destination is 221B Baker Street, where Holmes's daily violin practice is about to be interrupted by a very curious case involving a strange legacy, the Encyclopaedia Britannica, and an assortment of red-headed men.
Down that crow's gap. Stop shoving. I've been here all morning.
Vincent! You must help me. I'm drowning in a sea of bodies.
Here, take my arm. Now, forward, Mr. Wilson, to the steps of the officers of the League.
Oh, yes, but is it worth it, Vincent, all this?
Worth it? You cannot fail, Mr. Wilson. Now, just look. From palest canary to deepest claret, the nun. To match your own incandescent dross. Why, what you have above your brow is a veritable warning beacon. No, you are certain to be an exit then. Short hours, easy work, good pay. And this is not worth it.
Well,
hundreds of men, Mr. Wilson, they think it worth it. Would not be here otherwise.
Yes, I suppose you're right. But it is hard.
The hardest thing about any easy berth is the getting of it. But you, Mr. Wilson, have unique qualifications. So, onward.
Yes, onward.
Ever onward.
All right.
For the steps.
The Red-Headed League by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatised for radio by Vincent McInerney. With Clive Merrison as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring James Grout as Jabez Wilson and James Wilby as Vincent Spaulding. The Red-Headed League.
Passing down Baker Street one Saturday morning in the autumn of last year, that is to say, 1890, I decided to look in on my old friend Sherlock Holmes at number 221B. Admitting myself, I began to mount those familiar 17 stairs, wondering as I did so who or what I might find in his rooms. For the great detective, as you are no doubt aware, drew like a magnet all kinds and conditions of men and women, many of them as singular as their problems.
Holmes! Why, Holmes, I had no idea. Perhaps I shall wait in the other room.
No, no, my dear Watson, come in, I beg of you. You could not have arrived at a better time. Allow me to introduce Mr. Jabez Wilson, a pawnbroker with premises in Coburg Square, near the city.
Mr. Wilson?
While Dr. Watson, Mr. Wilson, has been my partner in many of my most successful cases, and will no doubt be equally indispensable to me in yours also.
Servant, Doctor.
And the case itself, Watson, promises to be one of the most unusual to yet come to my attention. Indeed, Mr. Wilson has begun a narrative which seems to bear out my observation that the strangest and most compelling events often leave room to doubt whether a crime has been committed at all. But you must hear for yourself from Mr. Wilson's own lips. So unique is the train of circumstances he's begun to describe.
At this, the portly client puffed out his large chest and simultaneously ran his finger down the advertisements in an old newspaper pulled from his greatcoat pocket. As he did so, I attempted, after the fashion of my companion, to read any indications which might be presented by his dress and appearance. An average British tradesman, I thought, obese, pompous and slow. Grey trousers, black frock coat, drab waistcoat, brassy Albert chain with square piece of metal dangling from it, faded top hat and overcoat. Nothing remarkable was my initial conjecture, but his blazing red head, an expression of extreme discontent. However...
To add to your own thoughts, Watson has done manual labour, takes snuff, is a Freemason, has travelled to China, and, of course, has written a lot lately.
Why, Mr. Holmes, how in the name of good fortune did you know all that? Even as to the fact I started as a ship's carpenter.
Your right hand, my dear sir, quite a size larger and more developed than your left. Ergo, you worked hard with it. Then your arc and compass breastpin denoting your Masonic order. China, of course, we get from Watson.
That square piece of metal on your watch chain, Mr. Wilson, a Chinese coin, perhaps.
Exactly. Well, as for the writing, what else could have produced that shiny 5 inches or so on the cuff of his right sleeve, where he rests it upon the desk?
Well, I never. I thought at first, Mr. Holmes, that you'd done something clever. Now I see there's nothing to it at all.
Oh, what? I begin to think I make a mistake in explaining, and my poor little reputation will suffer shipwreck if I continue to be so candid. But I interrupt your flow, Mr. Wilson, so begin again, I beg of you.
Well, as I was saying, Miss Holmes, I have a small pawnbroker's near the city. It's not a large affair, and, to be honest, not of late a particularly flourishing one.
You're there alone, Mr. Wilson?
Well, almost. A widower, you see, Doctor. Never any children. Just a 14-year-old girl does a bit of cooking and cleaning. Mm-hmm.
Assistants?
Well, one time I had two, but now, well, it's just one. I can't really afford him, except he comes for half wages to learn the business.
That is an obliging youth. And his name?
Spaulding. Vincent Spaulding. Though he's not such a youth, it's hard to put an age on him, really. But as for willing, and smart, too, he's very smart. In fact, could earn elsewhere twice what I give him. But if he's happy with me, why should I put ideas into his head? That's what I say, Miss Holmes.
Why, indeed. You are a lucky man.
Oh, he has his faults, too. There never was such a fellow for photography. Always snapping away with his camera when he could be improving his mind. And then diving down into the cellar. I allow him to use it as a developing chamber.
This assistant, Mr. Wilson, does he still favour the wet collodion method for developing, do you know? Or has he gone over to the gelatina bromide process? I've an interest myself.
I've no idea, sir, no idea. I never goes down there because of the light. He's very particular about the light, or lack of it, which condition he claims he must have. I can't afford to lose him, so I humour him and leave the cellar as his particular and private domain.
I don't know that Vincent Spaulding isn't almost as remarkable as your advertisement. Speaking of which...
Yes, the advertisement. Well, gentlemen, it was just this day, 8 weeks ago, and there am I, sitting in the back office, business not being brisk, you might say, listening to the bird and poking the coals, when suddenly...
Wilson! Wilson! Ah, there you are. And here is your paper. Oh, heaven knows how you concentrate with all this blessed ticking.
Clocks go with pawnbrokers, Mr. Spaulding, like sails with ships. You'll learn.
Well, I've certainly learned something from this paper. Lord, if I were a red-headed man.
Red-headed? Why, what is it?
Another vacancy on the Red-Headed League. Worth quite a small fortune to whoever gets it. And with there being more vacancies than men who qualify, well, I hear the trustees are at their wits' end what to do with the money.
A league? Did you say, Mr. Spaulding, of redheads?
You've never heard of them? That I do find strange. Let me put a kettle on while you read this, and I'll tell you what I know.
To the Red-Headed League. On account of the bequest of the late Ezekiah Hopkins of Lebanon, Pennsylvania, USA, there is now another vacancy open which entitles a member of the League to a salary of £4 a week for purely nominal services,
All red-headed men who are sound in body and mind and above the age of 21 are eligible. Apply in person on Monday at 11 o'clock to Duncan Ross in the offices of the League, 7 in Pope's Court, Fleet Street. What on earth does it mean?
Well, as to that, it seems the League was founded by an American millionaire, Ezekiel Hopkins. Very peculiar in his ways, and a violent redhead himself. He had no dependents, and when he died, his trustees found themselves charged with providing easy berths for other men of a fiery hue.
Surely there are millions who would apply for such a post.
Not so many as you might think. Confined to Londoners, I believe, due to the fact that Hopkins began from here. Then, of course, it is grown men only, and with the necessity for a positively volcanic topknot. Like yours, Mr. Wilson. I hear, too, the work is easy. Need not interfere with any other business a man may have.
Well, I'm sure that may be so, although...
True. What is the quick money against the security of life you enjoy here? The steady income.
Well, then again, if you really feel
indeed
that...
Indeed I do, Mr. Wilson. Indeed I do. Applications to be considered from 11 o'clock. Why, it is almost that now. Indeed, it is that now. So, your coat, Mr. Wilson, quickly, while I call a cab.
Very good.
At which point, you put up the shutters and set off for Pope's Court.
We did. Spalding was very willing to have a holiday, and as he seemed to know so much about it, well, it seemed only fair to take him with me.
Very fair. And absolutely essential, I'd say, wouldn't you, Watson?
Oh, undoubtedly. You went via Fleet Street, I take it, Mr. Wilson.
I did, Doctor. And I tell you, when we got there, such a sight as I never saw before, nor hope to see again. From north, south, east and west, every man who had a shade of red in his hair seemed to have gathered to answer the advertisement. Fleet Street was choked to the pavements, while Pope's Court looked like a fruit barrow full of blood oranges. There were so many redheads packed side by side. Straw-coloured lemon, orange, brick, Irish setter, liver, clay. I was for giving up in despair, but Spalding pointed out that there weren't many with that real vivid flame-coloured tint I have. And then, dragging me by the arm, pushed and pulled and batted me through the crowd and right up the steps to the office. There was a double stream on the steps, some going up in hope and some coming down in despair. No, be that as it may. My assistant wiggled us until we stood inside, in front of a small deal table, behind which sat a man with a head even redder than mine.
Hi, next. Good day, sir. My name is Spalding, and this is Mr. Jabez Wilson, willing, if chosen, to fill the vacancy in the red-headed league.
If chosen? If chosen, Mr. Spalding? Why, I cannot ever recall having seen anything so fine. What colour? What texture? Every requirement is satisfied. Aye, and it would be an injustice to hesitate. But...
What the devil are you doing, sir?
Simply part of my instruction, Mr. Wilson, to administer a violent tug to the hair of any successful applicant. For we have twice been deceived by wigs and once with paint. While I could tell you tales of cobbler's wax which would disgust you with human nature. However, there are tears in your eyes, so all is as it should be. Congratulations, Mr. Wilson, and welcome to the Red-Headed League.
But, Mr...
Ross, Duncan Ross, and now, if you will excuse me... You other gentlemen, the vacancy has been filled. Leave the office, if you will. Now, and convey the information to those still waiting outside. Gentlemen, if you please.
Ah, that's better. Now, to particulars. You are a married man, Mr. Wilson.
Widowed, I'm afraid, sir.
But children, I hope. Of a fine red-headed hue?
No, sir. We never... Though we always...
Dear me. For you must know the fund is for both the maintenance and the propagation of the red-headed. I don't really...
But, Mr. Ross, what an abundance in the article itself. What a vigour in its growth. What a colour in its pigmentation.
Aye, you're right, Mr. Spaulding. I was allowing what could be to blind me to what is. Mr. Wilson, when will you be able to enter on your new duties?
Well, as to that, Mr. Ross, that would depend on what they were. I mean, what hours they occupied. What the £4, was it?
Aye, per week. While the hours, why, 10 until 2 every day, starting next Monday. Every day, note, Mr. Wilson. Or, I might add, the position is forfeit. While the work, simply to copy out the Encyclopedia Britannica. Good enough? Aye, I see it is. So now, Mr. Wilson, I have an appointment and will simply leave you with my congratulations.
And leave me he did.
What a very, very interesting proposition.
Yeah, it was, Mr. Holmes. And I went home very pleased with my own good fortune, but...
A feeling that did not last?
No. By evening, Doctor, I must admit I felt a low spirit, I mean, not knowing whether the whole thing was a hoax.
But you were persuaded otherwise?
It was Vincent Spaulding, actually, Mr. Holmes, who brought me round to it again.
Ah.
So, the next morning, I bought a bottle of ink, a quill pen, and 7 sheets of foolscap, and started out for Pope's Court.
To find what?
Everything as promised. And Duncan Ross waiting to start me on the letter A.
And at the end of the week?
Well, he checked my work, complimented me on it, and then placed 4 shining sovereigns on the table, repeating the dose every Saturday thereafter.
But not today?
8 weeks. 8 weeks, regular as clockwork, I went there. Some days I saw him, some days I didn't. Some days a fleeting visit, some days a positive haunting. 8 weeks. Abbots, armour, architecture, Attica. With hopes of getting to the bees before long. 8 weeks and a sea of foolscap. And 4 sovs every Saturday. And then, this morning...
What about this morning?
10 o'clock on the dot, Mr. Holmes, as usual, with a spring in my step, as any man might on payday, to find the door locked with a square of cardboard tacked to it. I've got it here. Doctor, what do you think of that?
October the 9th, 1890. The Red-Headed League is dissolved.
Well, well, Mr. Wilson. Well, well.
Well, I can't see there's anything very funny. And if you can do nothing better than laugh at me, I'll take myself elsewhere.
No, no, Mr. Wilson, I beg you, reseat yourself. I really wouldn't miss your case for the world. It's most refreshingly unusual. But there is, if you'll excuse me saying so, something just a little funny about it. But I realise also it must have been very annoying. You were, I take it, Mr. Wilson, very annoyed.
Staggered is the word, Mr. Holmes. Staggered. And a bit angry. Though I realise I had no right to be. So, I sought out the landlord, who lived on the ground floor. He'd never heard of the League. Was under the impression the rooms were let to a solicitor named William Morris, who was waiting for his new office to be made ready, which had happened the day before.
This William Morris, who I suppose we can equate with Duncan Ross... You ascertained his new address from the landlord?
Indeed I did, Doctor. And went right round there to find a maker of artificial kneecaps.
Dear me.
My own sentiments, Doctor. Now, I express them a bit different. So, I went home to take the advice of my assistant, which was to wait, and no doubt I would hear by post. But that was not quite good enough, Mr. Holmes, as I did not wish to lose such a place without a struggle. And, as I had heard you were prepared to give advice to poor folk who needed it, I turned to you.
And you did very wisely, for your case is a remarkable one. And it's possible graver issues hang from it than might at first sight appear.
Well, grave enough? Well, I've lost £4 a week.
On the other hand, you've taken some £30 from this extraordinary league, to say nothing of the minute knowledge which you've gained on every subject that comes under the letter A. And now, Mr. Wilson, I feel it's time to review a few facts, after which I shall ask one question. Now, first the facts. You advertised for an assistant and a number of applicants turned up. From this number, you chose Vincent Spaulding. Why? Why? Because although obviously willing and exceptionally intelligent, he was prepared to come for what amounted to half wages. A man like that needs to be considered, to be brought under the microscope and have questions asked about him, or at least one question, which is, what, Mr. Wilson, does Vincent Spaulding look like?
Small, stout, very quick in his ways, no hair on his face. Oh, and one other thing, he has a white acid splash on his forehead.
What?
Well, I said a white splash.
Which means
of acid on...
rather two other things, I fancy, for are not also his ears pierced, as for ear rings.
Oh, yes, they're done by a gypsy when he was a lad, he claims. But how did you...
No time for that.
Yes, but an explanation.
Today
that,
is
surely.
Saturday. You shall have my opinion on Monday. Until then, behave exactly as normal. Pretend to take Spaulding's advice about waiting to hear in the post. Under no circumstances mention this visit. Do you intend to return to the shop immediately?
Why, I was
Might
thinking
I
of it.
Might I ask you to walk in the park instead? For an hour or so.
Walk? Well, if you insist, Mr. Holmes.
Recommend rather than insist, Mr. Wilson. And perhaps, yes, for nearer 2 hours. Oh, one further thing. What time do you go to bed?
To bed, sir? Why, 11 every night.
Excellent, excellent. Well, goodbye, then, for the moment. Watson, if you'd be so kind.
Yes, of course.
Here,
let me help you with the coat, Mr. Wilson.
Yes, well, I'm not sure that that's
Monday, and now goodbye, Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Holmes.
Yes, goodbye. Monday, goodbye. Well, Watson... what do you make of it all?
Frankly, Holmes, very little. It all appears very mysterious.
So it is. In fact, it is quite bizarre. Though, as a rule, the more bizarre a thing is, the less mysterious it proves to be. But I must, I feel, be prompt over this particular matter.
Then what do you intend to do?
To smoke. It is quite a three-pipe problem.
And at that, he immediately curled himself up in his chair, with his thin knees drawn up to his hawk-like nose, his eyes closed, and the black clay pipe thrusting out like the bill of some strange bird. I had come to the conclusion he had dropped off asleep, and indeed had myself begun to.
Watson! What? Watson, wake up!
Holmes, what is it?
Sarasate, Watson. Hmm? Place today at St. James's Hall. Now, do you think your patients could spare you for the afternoon?
Oh, I suspect so, Holmes. But whither my wife...
Nonsense, my friend. Mrs. Watson is a veritable mine of understanding.
True, although I'm not sure in Mary's case that to understand all necessarily means to forgive all. However...
Good man. Then first to the city, Coburg Square to be exact, then lunch and then music. I notice it's mainly a German programme, all to the good. German music, as you're no doubt aware, is introspective to a high degree, and today I would introspect.
We travel by the underground as far as Aldersgate, and a short walk brought us to Saxe Coburg Square, the scene of that singular story we had listened to earlier that morning. The square itself was a shabby, genteel place of four lines of dingy, two-storied brick houses, overlooking a small, railed-in, neglected park. On one of the corner houses of one of the four rows hung three gilt balls and a board announcing Jabez Wilson, obviously the place where our red-headed client carried on his business. Stopping in front of this particular dwelling, Holmes regarded it intently, his head on one side, his eager eyes shining brightly between half-closed lids. After this initial perusal, he walked slowly up our side of the square, looking very keenly at each individual house, then walked back again with a somewhat lighter step to the corner where both myself and the house of the pawnbroker stood. He paused, and then, suddenly, with his stick, and equally suddenly...
Hey, gentlemen. May I ask you to step in?
I think not. My friend and I have merely lost our way.
Ah. Perhaps you're old customers and wonder where Mr. Wilson is.
Let me tell you, my name is Vincent Spaulding, and I'm now his assistant. However, I have his complete confidence and pride myself on my discretion, given the delicate nature of our business here. Now, are you sure you will not step in a moment?
I am afraid we do not have time, Mr. Spaulding, given the delicate nature of our business is simply to get to the Strand as quickly as possible.
I see. Well, then, third right, fourth left. Good day.
This way, Watson. Do not look back.
Holmes, did you see it? The acid stain on his forehead.
Indeed. Smart fellow, that Mr. Vincent Spaulding. Possibly fourth smartest in London. While as for daring, why, he may be the third.
Still, now he's been seen and identified.
Left here. Although, Watson, it was not specifically to see Mr. Spaulding that I called, but rather the knees of his trousers.
His trouser knees? What on earth could they tell you?
Why, what I expected.
And why beat the pavement?
My dear doctor, this is the time for observation rather than talk. We are spies in an enemy country. Ah, left again.
Good Lord. Farringdon Street.
Indeed. Fashionable Farringdon Street. Yet the back of these fine shops and buildings abut onto that line of houses we've just left in Saxe Coburg Square. A line that includes that of our friend Mr. Wilson.
Who would have thought it? Such prosperity here, well, two turns of a block away.
Yes, they are interesting, are they not? These shops on this particular block. Mortimer's, the tobacconist's, the little newspaper shop, the Coburg branch of the City and Suburban Bank, then the vegetarian restaurant, and finally McFarlane's carriage building depot, which carries us to the next corner and means we've now done our work and are due some play. Mm-hmm. So, first a sandwich and a cup of coffee, then off to Violin Land, where all is sweetness and delicacy and harmony, and there are no red-headed clients to vex us with their conundrums. Come, Watson. Sarasate and Mendelssohn call, though not, of course, in that order.
No, of course not.
Once in St. James's Hall, my friend became a different man. A very capable performer himself and composer of no ordinary merit, all afternoon he sat in the stalls, wrapped in the most perfect happiness, waving his long, thin fingers in time to the music. His gentle, smiling face and languid, dreamy eyes, as unlike those of Holmes the sleuth-hound, Holmes the relentless, keen-witted, ready-handed criminal agent, as it was possible to conceive. I have often thought that he was possessed of a dual nature in his singular character. One of those conditions now beginning tentatively to intrude into the medical journals. I had mentioned as much to my wife. She, however, had a far more downright opinion of Holmes's moods. For myself, I felt his extreme exactness and astuteness in detection represented a reaction against the poetic and contemplative mood occasions such as the present brought to the fore, and that the swing of his nature would shortly take him from extreme languor to devouring energy, promising an evil time to those he had set himself to hunt down.
A memorable performance, Watson, both soothing and invigorating. Ever the hallmark of great art. And now you wish to go home, no doubt?
It would be as well, Holmes. Arrangements pertaining to my practice, you know. And, of course, Mary.
Yes, well, I, too, have arrangements to make regarding, as it were, my practice. The Coburg Square business is serious. I believe a considerable crime is being contemplated. I think we'll be in time to prevent it, but it being Saturday complicates matters. Be that as it may, one thing is sure, that I will need your help tonight.
Ah, at what time?
10 o'clock, at Baker Street.
I shall be there.
Ah, good man. And Watson.
Yes, Holmes?
Come armed.
And with that, Holmes vanished into the crowd as if he had never been. For my part, I made my way home to Kensington and my wife. Mary, bless her, had rightly guessed where I had been and with whom. yet chid me no more than to accuse me of marrying her under the false pretense that while all the world believed she held my heart, in reality it belonged to Holmes. We passed the early part of the evening quietly and after our usual fashion. For me, an open fire, an armchair, and a good book, while Mary sat quietly at a work table bent over some sewing. Then, as nine struck, I made preparations to leave. Marking and closing my book, I lifted the bull pup onto my vacant chair, better to guard its mistress. Then, taking down my overcoat, I slipped my service revolver into the right-hand pocket, said my farewells, and so set off. I crossed the park and entered Baker Street to find the door of 221B open and a pair of hansoms waiting. Making my way upstairs, I was surprised to hear the sound of voices from Holmes's rooms. I entered to find him in animated conversation with two men. One I recognized as Peter Jones, the police agent. The other, a long, thin, sad-faced man with a very shiny hat and oppressively respectable frock coat.
Ah, Watson, our party is complete. I think you know Mr. Jones of Scotland Yard.
Inspector.
So now let me introduce you to Mr. Merriweather, her further companion in our night's adventures.
Mr. Merriweather.
How do you do? Hunting in a pack again, you see, Doctor. Fred and Mr. Holmes here is a wonderful man for starting a chase. All he wants is an old dog or two to help him do the running down.
Ah, yes, indeed, Mr. Jones.
As long as the chase is not after a wild goose. As to that, Mr. Merriweather, I feel as I might speak for the complete confidence you may place in Mr. Holmes. His methods, true, are sometimes fantastical, but I hope you won't mind me saying so. He has the makings of a detective in him. And I'll go even further. It's not too much to say that once or twice he has been more nearly correct than the official force.
My dear Jones, praise indeed.
All very well. But this is the first Saturday in 27 years I've missed my rubber of whist, and I am a man of settled habits.
You may console yourself, Mr. Merriweather, with thought of the stakes you'll be playing for later this evening, which will be far more exciting than you've ever known heretofore. Mm. As for you, Jones, the prospect is of a man you've been waiting to lay your hands on for a long time now.
Yes, John Augustus Clay, nephew of a royal duke. Eton and Oxford, then murderer, smasher, thief and forger.
Good heavens, Holmes. Almost impeccable credentials. Even for you.
If you will permit an observation from one who may perhaps seem a layman, doesn't this, Mr. Clay, seem rather too well known to be still at liberty?
Bless you, sir, that's just it. Crack a crib in Scotland one week, raising money to build an orphanage in Cornwall the next. A strange mixture of saint and sinner, and cool as a cucumber. Why, I've never set eyes on him yet, though I've been after him for years.
Though you, I trust, Mr. Holmes, may perhaps be able to recognize him, should you see him?
He has a white acid scar on his forehead, received when he and some confederates were making a set of forged plates completely to undermine the currency of Patagonia. Mm. One of Clay's colleagues took exception to what he considered Clay's high-handed, aristocratic mien and threw a beaker of acid at him. So, Mr. Merriweather, not only will I recognize Clay, but firmly hope to introduce you to him before the evening is out. But now it's past 10. Watson, my hunting crop from the wall, if you will. Then, gentlemen, the hansoms.
At the beginning of our drive, as we rattled through an endless labyrinth of gas-lit streets, Holmes was not very communicative, preferring, it seemed, to lie back humming snatches from the works we had heard earlier that afternoon. Then suddenly, he began one of those curious semi-monologues during which, although I was present, he spoke almost as if to himself, and without ever looking in my direction. The half-smile that had crossed Merriweather's face when Holmes had described Clay's aristocratic mien came ironically to my mind.
Something of a fossil, old Merriweather. Jurassic period, perhaps. But for the £30,000 interest in all this, we must have him along, I feel.
£30,000, Holmes? Who is he?
Jones, I also consider it well to have with us. Not a bad fellow, though an absolute imbecile in his profession. However, as brave as a bulldog and tenacious as a lobster. Ah, we've turned into Farringdon Street. Stop here, cabbie. And Merriweather? Why, tonight, Watson, he is simply our guide to the underworld.
And leaving the Hansoms, we followed Merriweather into that same underworld. First, he conducted us down a narrow way. Then, through a side door he opened with a large key. Then, through a massive iron gate. Then, with a lantern he lit, down a dark, earth-smelling passage. Then a further massive door, which he opened with an even larger key. And being passed through that, we stood in what seemed a vault or cellar, piled round with crates and massive boxes.
Excellent. Excellent. The lantern, if I may. Jones, check for intruders, if you will. Though our quarry will hardly be astir yet. How we are at present, Doctor, there's no doubt you've divined, in the vaults of the City and Suburban Bank, Mr. Merriweather being the chairman of directors of that same establishment. Now. Good. No vulnerability from above.
Nor below, Mr. Holmes, if you'll allow me to demonstrate.
Merriweather!
So it almost sounds hollow.
I really must ask you to be a little more quiet, Merriweather. You've already imperiled the success of our whole expedition. Might I beg you to sit on one of the boxes and not interfere? Jones, anything lurking among the crates?
Nothing, Mr. Holmes.
Ah, good. So, Watson, the lantern here, if you please. Yes. So, gentlemen, by my reckoning, we have an hour or so to wait until our good friend Mr. Wilson retires to bed and Spaulding begins his photographic practices once more with his assistant. For rest assured, this is work for more than one pair of hands. These boxes contain the gold, I assume, Merriweather?
Of course.
Some sort of special assignment, Mr. Merriweather?
30,000 napoleons borrowed from the Bank of France, Doctor, for an occasion when we had to be seen to be strengthening our collateral. In the event it was not acquired and has lain here since, unpacked and awaiting reshipment. This crate, which Mr. Holmes has adjourned me to sit on, contains 2,000 of those same napoleons packed in lead foil.
If you please, gentlemen, that is enough. Now, a final point or two before we begin our vigil. Mr. Jones, have you settled the depositions of your men?
Two of my best waiting outside the front door in Coburg Square.
Excellent. Now, gentlemen, in a moment I will draw the screen over the dark lantern, after which time there will be complete silence until I give the word. Jones, stand near my side. Merriweather behind the case. Now, Watson.
Yes.
These are desperate men and may try to use their guns. If so, have no compunction about shooting them down. Cock your revolver now, which will be the last sound I wish to hear until I give the order to move in.
I primed my revolver, laying it in front of me on top of the case. And an instant later, the vault was plunged into utter and suffocating darkness as Holmes covered the dark lantern. Then how very slowly time seemed to move. One part of my mind knew that the hour could not yet possibly be up. Another felt that the night must almost have gone, and dawn would even now be breaking in the cool London street somewhere overhead. My limbs became weary and stiff, yet I feared to change my position. As with the blind, my hearing became so acute that I could, towards the end, come to distinguish the deeper in-breath of Jones from the thin sighing note of the bank director. Suddenly, a needle of light appeared between two of the central floor flags. At first, it seemed a single golden spark, then a chink, then a yellow spill, then a lurid gash. Then, without warning, a hand appeared, a white, almost womanly hand, whose fingers writhed momentarily within the light and as quickly withdrew. And then...
All clear, Archie. Give me a bunker. Now the chisel's in the bag. And finally you. Here, my arm.
A fine hand, Mr. Wilson. What resolution in your arms, subdued passion in your bees.
No time for that, Archie.
Ah, but will the quills last out? That's what I'm wondering.
Come on. Up with you. Right, my boy. And here you are.
And here you will stay. Now, Jones!
Jump, Archie! Jump, I'll swing for it.
With you, my lad.
No, you don't, Cleve!
Take up his gun. It's no use, Clay. Your chance is gone.
Perhaps. My pal is all right, though, I fancy, even though he's left his coattails behind. You won't get a conviction on that.
We won't have to. We have men posted at the front door in Coburg Street. When Archie, alias Mr. Duncan Ross, emerges from this cellar and tries to make a run for it, he will soon find himself occupying another one, though this time in Scotland Yard. Eh, Mr. Jones?
But smaller, Mr. Holmes. Smaller and more secure. Not for nothing after all, eh, Mr. Merriweather?
So, you are Sherlock Holmes.
And you, John Augustus Clay.
And did you ever find your way to the Strand, Mr. Holmes, on that piece of business you mentioned?
Once I saw the disposition of the buildings in Farringdon Street, not to mention your trouser knees, I realized there was more pressing business nearer home.
I see. Oh, you seem to have done the thing very completely, Mr. Holmes. I compliment you.
And are you? The red-headed idea was both new and effective.
I'm not sure effectiveness is any substitute for success. My congratulations again, however, for what they are worth.
Yeah, it's all very nice. Now we'll see how their derbies fit.
I beg you will not touch me with your filthy hands! You may not be aware, but I have royal blood in my veins.
Come on, hold them out.
Have the goodness also when you address me to say sir and please.
Well, that beats everything, Mr. Holmes. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Clay. Now you've condescended to have the cuffs on, perhaps you'll march upstairs with me to get a cab to carry your highness to the police station.
That is better. Hardly acceptable, but better.
Come along.
Gentlemen.
Mr. Holmes, I don't know how the bank can repay you. There is no doubt to my mind you have defeated one of the most determined and ingenious attempts at robbery that has come within my experience.
I agree. And agree that I do not see how yours or any other financial institution could repay my cogitations. At the same time, I have been at some small expense over this matter, for which I expect some degree of recompense. Watson, shall we? Mr. Merriweather, you'll want to lock up, I trust. So, why go to so much trouble in the first place?
Quite.
Mm. More whiskey, old fella. Oh. Help yourself. Mm. Now. Ah, yes. So it seemed perfectly obvious to me that the only possible object of this fantastic business of the advertisement and the copying of the Britannica was to get our not very bright pawnbroker out of the house for a number of hours every day. And, as I intimated to Clay, it would be difficult to think of a better idea than the one he eventually pursued. It was probably suggested initially by the colour of the hair of Clay's accomplice, Archie, alias Duncan Ross. So, they fixed upon Wilson's colouring as the line, set £4 per week as the lure, and caught their fish. £4 being nothing to men playing for 30,000.
Now, what was it first that alerted your suspicions? Clay, Spaulding as he was, coming for half wages?
Exactly. Why would someone of Spaulding's undoubted attributes take such a nondescript position? Mm. If there had been a woman in the house, I would have suspected a mere vulgar intrigue, but that was obviously out of the question. Yet there had been elaborate preparation and expenditure. But for what? Hmm? Then Wilson mentioned the cellar. You asked your wonderfully pertinent question about photographic developing, which told us Wilson was totally excluded from that room, and then, the game was on.
I must confess, I suspected something about the cellar. It could get no further myself.
Then I found we were dealing with Clay, one of the coolest, determined, and most daring criminals in London, who was doing something in the cellar of a small pawnbroker's. This I had to see for myself. You remember, I beat on the pavement in front of the house, simply to see if the cellar stretched in front or behind. And as it was solid in front of the house, all the action was obviously happening towards the rear of the building. Then I knocked at the door. I hardly looked at Clay's face. His trouser knees were what I wanted to see, worn, wrinkled, and stained with hours of burrowing. The only remaining point was what they were burrowing for, and round the corner in Farringdon Road stood the answer, a branch of the City and Suburban Bank.
But how did you know it would be tonight?
The League, my dear fellow, closing up its offices meant Wilson's usefulness was over. That is, they must have completed the tunnel. A further important factor from their point of view, of course, was that a robbery carried out on a Saturday would give them 2 clear days for their escape.
How beautiful. What chain of reasoning.
Such a length. Yet every link rings true.
It saved me from ennui. That terrible boredom that, alas, I already feel closing in on me again, even now. My life is spent in one long attempt to escape from the commonplace of existence. These little problems help me to do so. And when there are no problems...
Holmes.
It is late, Watson. And Mrs. Watson.
Holmes, you know how I feel about the cocaine.
Man is nothing. It is the work that is everything. As Flaubert wrote to Jorson. Good night, my friend.
Holmes.
Watson. Good night.
In The Red-Headed League, Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Merrison and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams. Jabez Wilson was played by James Grout and Vincent Spaulding by James Wilby. With Nigel Carrington as Inspector Jones, James Green as Mr. Merriweather, and Sam Graham as Duncan Ross. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Red-Headed League was dramatized for radio by Vincent McInerney and directed by Patrick Rayner.
Tomorrow's adventure is called A Case of Identity. Sherlock Holmes agrees to help locate a missing husband, but can he do so without leaving 221B Baker Street?
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 5 o'clock. Good morning. This is Susan Ray with comedy. In half an hour, we're keeping it kosher with the attractive young rabbi. It's bar mitzvah time, an occasion for joy and celebration, were it not for the fact that three very different rabbis are in attendance. And this afternoon in the 4 o'clock show, the author behind this week's story, Terry Pratchett, will be back with another book that shaped his life. And we will find out how to print a house. Yes, a full-blown house. No, really. Now, a real cultural treat, as the Royal Dingle Company invites Brian Cox to run a Bard's Tragedy Masterclass. A tour de force, and no mistake.
We present Desmond Olivier Dingle's Complete Life and Works of William Shakespeare by Desmond Olivier Dingle. Episode 3. But first, a word from our host, the artistic director of the Royal Dingle Company, Desmond Olivier Dingle. Yes? Fine. Unfortunately, owing to an administrative oversight, Desmond Olivier Dingle and also the Royal Dingle Company seem to have been inadvertently detained. And this week, our special guest is internationally renowned actress of stage, screen and radio, recently acclaimed for her performances in Arcadia and the controversially explicit The Men's Room, Miss...
Hello.
Brian Cox.
Sorry I'm late. Hello.
Hello. As I say, one of our leading, most legendary stars of stage, screen, and radio.
Oh, I wouldn't say legendary.
No.
Sorry.
And,
Sorry.
Radio.
Actually, I've never done any radio.
Live radio.
Live radio?
Yes.
No, oddly enough.
Fascinating.
Love to do it. I mean, live, record it. I've just never been asked. You know, so if any budding young BBC producer happens to be... have I come the right week? I was supposed to come next week, but the producer apparently rang and asked me to come a week early to be interviewed and run a masterclass on Shakespearean tragedy.
What?
Fortunately, I'm not due in Russia till next week.
God.
I should have been there this week, but now it's next week, which is a bit of luck. Is there a problem?
No, no. Apparently, I've got to start the show on my own. Right.
Is there anything I can do to help?
No! No, no. Sorry.
Sorry.
You sit there. Sorry.
Right. So, tragedy.
Let's kick straight off now with In the Psychiatrist's Chair. With Desmond Olivier... Without Desmond Olivier Dingle, as it happens, with In the Hot Seat this week...
What?
What?
In the what?
In the Psychiatrist's Chair.
Psychiatrist's Chair? I thought I was here to do a masterclass in Shakespeare.
Yes, yes. We can't do the masterclass without the actors, can we? So, we're going to kick off, as I said, with In the Psychiatrist's Chair...
I'm not sure about being psychoanalysed over the air.
No one's going to analyse you. We're just filling in, right?
Right. Well,
So, what are you about to do, then?
Well, I'm about to go to Russia, as it happens.
On holiday?
No, 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 I direct there at the Moscow Arts Theatre.
The what?
It's probably the most famous theatre in the world.
Oh, is it indeed? So what about...